And this is something that we want as human beings. And he will delay your death. And that's the second thing that human beings want. In this life itself, there are two things that me and you, we constantly seek on a daily basis: to live long and to have more money. And Amir al-Mu'minin says, well, that is simple. All you have to do is share with your relatives, go to them, give them a phone call, ask about them, give them a visit. If you do so, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will increase your wealth and will prolong your life. As simple as that. When he talks about the Jahiliyyah era, when he talks about the pagans and how they lived, he says, Al-arhamu maqtu'ah. Back in the day, before Islam, relationships were severed, were cut. People don't used to care much about the relation. Wal-gharatu mashnuna. And they not only that, but they used to do what? They used to kill each other. They used to fight and go into war. Because back in the day, you would have a whole tribe consist of one family, and then you have another tribe consist of another family, and sometimes these two tribes are cousins. What happens between them? Not only the relationship between them is cut, but from time to time, they invade one another. That was the pagan era. When Islam came, Islam changed that. So he included them to be one part, to be one unit. So then he says that you need to have this equality amongst you when it comes to you, your family, and other families that are related. In fact, when it comes to the entire area, city, community that you live in, you need to keep that. You need to maintain that. So he expands the circle even further. He says, من أتاه الله مالا فليسل به القرابة. He who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives him wealth, let him use it to get closer to his relatives. So sometimes you get close to your close relatives, and sometimes you have to get even closer to your further relatives. So the more you expand yourself from what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you, the more Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you in return. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi from here, he's trying to maintain the right of the family, the right of relatives, be it far or be it close. And he expands that circle and he says, okay, if you do this and he does the same thing and everyone does the same thing, then we're going to have a very beautiful society that maintains the rights of one another. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
In the limelight. Exiled American whistleblower Edward Snowden, whose leaked documents revealed that in 2007 the Israeli regime was flagged as a top espionage threat against the U.S. government, went further, saying in July that NSO Group's industry should not exist. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is titled Spyware Created by Israeli Regime Firm Used to Hack U.S. Officials' iPhones. Stay tuned for more. Multiple news outlets revealed recently that Apple notified at least 11 U.S. State Department officials that their iPhones were recently hacked by an unknown party or parties with a spyware developed by the private Israeli regime firm NSO Group. The bombshell, first reported by Reuters, comes after Apple sued NSO Group last month in an effort to protect iPhone users from its Pegasus spyware, which the Israeli regime company claims to only sell to government law enforcement and intelligence agencies, and was the focus of a major reporting project earlier this year. Citing multiple unnamed sources, the Washington Post and Reuters explained that U.S. State Department employees based in Uganda or elsewhere in East Africa were targeted over several months, and the intrusions represent the widest known hacks of U.S. officials through NSO technology. According to the Reuters, a senior Biden administration official speaking on condition he not be identified said the threat to U.S. personnel abroad was one of the reasons the administration was cracking down on companies such as NSO and pursuing new global discussion about spying limits. The official added that they have seen systematic abuse in multiple countries involving NSO's Pegasus spyware. The National Security Council said in a statement reported by the Post that we have been acutely concerned that commercial spyware like NSO Group software poses a serious counterintelligence and security risk to U.S. personnel, which is one of the reasons why the Biden-Harris administration has placed several companies involved in the development and proliferation of these tools on the Department of Commerce's entity list, unquote. Spokespeople for Apple and the State Department declined to comment to Reuters, though the latter also noted that the Commerce Department recently added NSO Group to entity list based on a determination that they developed and supplied the spyware to foreign governments that used this tool to maliciously target government officials, journalists, business people, activists, academics, and embassy workers. While officials at the Ugandan embassy in Washington, D.C. also did not comment, the Zionist regime embassy in the United States Capitol gave a statement to Reuters addressing the fact that the Zionist regime's Ministry of War approves export licenses for the spyware company. The Israeli regime spokesperson said cyber products like the one mentioned are supervised and licensed to be exported to governments only for purposes related to counterterrorism and severe crimes, adding the licensing provisions are very clear, and if these claims are true, it is a severe violation of these provisions. An NSO Group spokesperson told the news agency that the relevant accounts were canceled, and if an internal investigation finds that these actions indeed happened with NSO's tools, the involved customers will be terminated permanently and legal actions will take place. The representative added that the company will cooperate with any relevant government authority and present the full information we will have, unquote. Facebook sued NSO in 2019, claiming the Zionist regime's firm's spyware was used on its messaging service, WhatsApp. Will Cathcart, head of WhatsApp, tweeted recently, "We have been calling NSO a national security threat for years. This reporting shows again why we need to hold NSO accountable for their actions and why governments need to support increased security online." John Scott Railton, a senior researcher at the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto, also responded to the revelations on Twitter, saying that NSO Group has been an in plain sight national security threat for years, and it is embarrassing that it took a private company to warn them. He asked, are their victims not notified by Apple? How about the overseas posted personnel using Androids? Does the State Department know now? A multi-agency investigation is immediately needed. Senator Ron Wyden similarly told the Post that companies that enable their customers to hack U.S. government employees are a threat to America's national security and should be treated as such by the government. Wyden added, I want to be sure the State Department and the rest of the federal government has the tools to detect hacks and respond to them quickly. Last month, Apple filed a lawsuit in a California-based U.S. District Court accusing NSO Group of violating its terms and conditions, as well as state and federal laws. Apple is seeking a permanent injunction to ban the firm from using its devices, services, or software. That suit came after the Pegasus Project, an investigation into NSO's spyware, published in July by more than 80 journalists from 17 media organizations in 10 countries. Coordinated by Forbidden Stories with the technical support of Amnesty International, the project focused on leak of 50,000 phone numbers of potential surveillance targets, including activists, heads of state, and journalists around the world. The Pegasus Project spurred worldwide calls for an immediate moratorium on the export, sale, transfer, and use of such spyware. Exiled American whistleblower Edward Snowden, whose leaked documents revealed that in 2007 the Zionist regime was flagged as a top espionage threat against the U.S. government, went further, saying in July that NSO Group's industry should not exist.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. ¶¶
عليه السلام، قدر الرجل على قدر همته، وصدقه على قدر مروءته، وشجاعته على قدر أنفته، وعفته على قدر غيرته.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "The worth of a man is according to his courage. His truthfulness is according to his balance of temper. His valor is according to his self-respect, and his chasteness is according to his sense of shame."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali and how Imam Ali's persona is applicable to today's day and age. We find that Imam Ali himself adhered to certain manners and he lived by certain principles and fundamentals. And it is these principles and fundamentals from his life that we learn so many things and things which we can apply in our own lives. For example, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam has said and has lived by this idea that a scholar who does not know a matter, if asked a question, must not be ashamed of saying, "Allahu alam, Allah knows better." You know, dear friends, it's interesting, but you don't have to be a scholar to be able to apply this in your life. For example, if you're a religious scholar or you are a religious student, then of course this directly applies to these kind of individuals, those who call themselves Islamic scholars and those who call themselves the students of Islam, or talabe, as is known in Farsi. These individuals, when asked a question and if they don't know, they shouldn't be ashamed to say that they don't know. They shouldn't be ashamed to say, "Well, Allah knows better." It's interesting, but if we were to apply this, let's just take it as an aspect of a religious scholar or a student of religion. Instead of making up answers for something that we do not know, and of course, making up an answer is just going to lead people astray. Instead of making up an answer and coming up with something on the fly, as it is said, if we were to actually just say, "I don't know, but for example, I will make sure to search it up, and if I find the answer, I will provide it to you. Allah knows better." How many different kinds of misguidance and misinformation and misconceptions could be saved from the people? But you know what? What is interesting and beautiful about Imam Ali and his personality and his statements and his way of life and his manners and morals and ethics is that it's not limited to just one aspect. So we talked about religious scholars, we talked about a religious student or a student of religion, but this applies to probably every profession. For example, if you're a car mechanic, or if you're a doctor, or if you're a pharmacist, or if you're a teacher, if you're a university professor, or even if you're a mother or a father, and somebody asks you a question and you don't know the answer, instead of making something up and giving wrong information to your patient or to your student or to your children, it is safer for you and for the person that you are addressing to just merely say, "I do not know, Allah knows better, and furthermore, if I search and find the answer, I will provide it to you. What a different kind of world, what a safer world, what a more prosperous world we would live in if we followed these kind of teachings and sayings by Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so yet, dear friends, another profound, simple, but beautiful, life-changing lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
His name brings about a sense of strength in the heart. His remembrance is a source of inspiration for the souls. His legacy is widespread throughout the centuries and around the world. When we examine this phenomenal character, this individual that today we are not able to appreciate all of his qualities, and you know, they call us people who exaggerate who Ali ibn Abi Talib was. One of the scholars says, I was told, you exaggerate, you speak too much fada'il of Ali. You are someone who is excessively in love with this man. I said to him, don't worry, I am still at the aim and I haven't yet gone further. He said, what do you mean? He said, don't think I'm still at the A of Ali. I am at the A of the alphabets of fada'il of Ali. No doubt you and I are not worried when people come and tell us, what is this association with Ali ibn Abi Talib that you have? Because we have understood his excellence. We have understood that through him is salvation. A man who was born in the best of places and martyred in the best of places. and was martyred on the best of nights. A man who lived his life for the association of Allah and Tawheed. A man who gave everything for the religion of Allah. A man whose eloquence and bravery and wisdom and dedication is unmatched after the Holy Prophet. Why would we reduce as our association and our remembrance of this honorable individual? This association must continue and it must live on. Yet for us to strengthen that bond with Ali the Magnificent, Ali the man whose heart was full of love towards others, Ali who wanted his followers to follow in his footsteps in the best way. Those around Amir al-Mu'mineen recognize this. Salman al-Muhammadi al-Farisi, Ridwanullahi ta'ala alayh, one day was walking behind Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen looks behind and he sees that Salman takes every step that Ali takes, exactly placing his feet. Look at that. And the way that those around Amir al-Mu'mineen recognized that this association is blessed. This association is the association of salvation.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
At least 223 Palestinians were killed during those protests, which began on March 30, 2018 and concluded in December 2019. 7 persons with disabilities were killed during the protests, according to Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is titled, "The Israeli Regime Kills People with Disabilities." Stay tuned for more. To mark International Day of Persons with Disabilities, the Israeli regime military tweeted a photo of its communications tower in Tel Aviv lit in purple. The Zionist regime military claimed that the gesture was in honor of people with disabilities in occupied territories and around the world. Twitter users quickly seized on the irony and hypocrisy by highlighting the Zionist regime's myriad crimes against Palestinians with disabilities. Earlier this week, an Israeli and Palestinian human rights group published a report exposing the Zionist regime's sham investigations into the killing and maiming of protesters during Gaza's Great March of Return. At least 223 Palestinians were killed during those protests, which began on March 30, 2018 and concluded in December 2019. 7 persons with disabilities were killed during the protest, according to Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group. A UN commission of inquiry found that the Zionist regime's snipers shot at persons with disabilities, knowing they were clearly recognizable as such during the Great March of Return. Additionally, more than 13,000 Palestinians were injured during the protest, some 8,000 by live fire, about 2,400 by rubber-coated metal bullets, and almost 3,000 by tear gas canisters that hit them directly. B'Tselem and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights stated in their joint report recently, "Those figures do not reflect the thousands more people injured from tear gas inhalation during the protest. Of course, of the persons wounded, 156 lost limbs," the rights groups state, adding, "None of these cases were investigated." B'Tselem and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights described the Zionist regime's self-investigation mechanism as a smokescreen intended to deter the scrutiny of international criminal court. The tribunal in The Hague only pursues war crimes cases when the states are unwilling or unable to carry out meaningful domestic investigations. The Zionist regime is unwilling to investigate abuses against Palestinians by its forces, and therefore the responsibility to ensure accountability for these violations now lies with the ICC, B'Tselem stated. Extrajudicial execution of Iyad Hallaq is an example. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, has called for a war crimes investigation into the killing of Iyad Hallaq by the Zionist regime police in Al-Quds last year. Hallaq, 31, was walking to a school for persons with disabilities that he attended when he was gunned down. The Zionist regime has withheld surveillance camera footage from the area where Hallaq was killed and imposed a gag order on Hallaq family's lawyer to prevent information about court proceedings from being made public, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime systematically resorts to excessive use of force, including against Palestinians with disabilities. 10 Palestinians with disabilities were killed by occupation forces in the West Bank and Gaza in 2018 alone. Persons with disabilities were among the more than 250 Palestinians killed during the Zionist regime's 11-day attack on Gaza in May. Yad Salha, who used a wheelchair, was killed in an Israeli regime airstrike on his home on May 19th. Amani Mahawish, Yad's wife, who was 8 months pregnant, was killed along with their 2-year-old daughter, Nagam. Salha was among 6 people with disabilities killed during the offensive, according to Medical Aid for Palestinians, citing the Palestinian Medical Relief Society and National Society for Rehabilitation. The bombardment also affected several health and rehabilitation facilities, including 24 organizations working with people with disabilities, Medical Aid for Palestinians added. Some 3,000 people with disabilities were displaced within Gaza during the bombardment. Palestinians with disabilities experience severe difficulty evacuating civilian buildings under attack, increasing the risk of injury and death. Medical Aid for Palestinians noted earlier this year, deaf people in Gaza had difficulty accessing information during those terrifying 11 days. "I felt that I was in terrible danger whenever the house shook," Saadia Mehrdad, who is deaf, told the Electronic Intifada earlier this year, adding, "But I did not know where the bombs were landing." Older people are also acutely vulnerable during the Zionist regime's attacks on Gaza, coordinated from Tel Aviv Military Command Tower, illuminated in purple. "Wars take a heavy toll on us," Ishaq al-Sayyid told the Electronic Intifada in July, adding, "They deprive us of any sense of comfort or safety. I am still in a state of anxiety following the May attack." The consulate said it was proud to be working with a Palestinian group to enhance the rights and inclusion of people with disabilities in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, however, the UK government has allied with the Zionist regime against accountability for all Palestinians, including those with disabilities, by opposing the investigation underway at the International Criminal Court, ICC. Karim Khan, a British national, began his term as ICC chief prosecutor in June. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that he hoped that the election of Khan and another Briton as a judge would help serve reform at a court. Human Rights Watch condemned Johnson's remark as a brazen assault on ICC independence. EU sponsors Solidarity Film Festival is another example in this regard. The UK isn't alone in its empty gestures toward human rights while helping the Zionist regime consolidate the prevailing situation of impunity. The European Union is sponsoring, along with various Zionist regime agencies, the upcoming Solidarity Film Festival in Tel Aviv that it says puts human rights at the forefront. Sponsorship of the festival is a rejection of the Palestinian call for a cultural boycott of the Zionist regime. The cultural boycott call is inspired by the global movement that helped end apartheid in South Africa. Meanwhile, the EU has yet to reject and condemn the Zionist regime's use of a draconian anti-terror law against 6 Palestinian human rights and social service organizations. 3 of the groups, including Al-Haq, Al-Damir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, are assisting the International Criminal Court's war crimes investigation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The cinematic where the EU-sponsored festival is to be held is a convenient 5-minute walk from the Zionist regime military headquarters in Tel Aviv. Presumably, Palestinian film fans in the West Bank will not be allowed to pass through military checkpoints to attend the Tel Aviv festival. That would be too much human rights and solidarity to expect from the Zionist regime and the EU.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, knowledge. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of knowledge and its impact on the Islamic lifestyle. We know that knowledge is one of the important parts of the human life, and the human advances was based on the knowledge and the sciences. Therefore, when we look at the Islamic lifestyle and the Islamic teachings itself, we see that there is a lot of emphasis on learning and seeking knowledge. Therefore, in many verses as well as in many narrations, it is said that you should go and seek knowledge. For example, in one of the narrations of Imam Ali, he said that اكتسبوا العلم يكسبكم الحياة, that you need to seek knowledge, ilm. The word ilm is used, which is knowledge. And through this, you will seek your life, you will expand, have developments, have the developments in your life. So the knowledge is the base of all the developments that the human beings have in their lifestyle. Therefore, in the Islamic lifestyle, if we want to have developments, especially when Islam is not against the sciences, it's not against the knowledge, and it talks about the human advancements. Therefore, it is highly recommended in the Islamic lifestyle to seek knowledge. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of knowledge and its importance in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said in the Arabic terminology, the word which is used for knowledge is ilm. Ilm is said to a knowledge or a science or something which we learn when we practically apply those things. For example, if someone learns how to make a table and he gets the pre-knowledge, we can say, of how to make a table. Like we need some nails, we need wood, we need hammer, maybe a glue, and there must be a specific size of that table. So we know all these things. We get this information. We have all the information, the necessary information, in order to make a table. But when someone practically changes this information into a real table, or it applies his information that he gathered into a real table, then it is known as knowledge, it is known as ilm. So we need to remember that ilm is always with the practice, and when someone practically can do or convert his information that he has gained into his practical life, then that thing becomes ilm for him, and therefore we call alim to one who has ilm. Scholar is the person who changes, who converts his information that he has, all those informations into practice. Therefore, we need to when we talk about the knowledge, we need to make sure that knowledge is not about reading books. Knowledge means that you practically apply what you learn, inshallah. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
French President Emmanuel Macron wrapped up his two-day tour of the Persian Gulf after a meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on Saturday. During Macron's visit to Jeddah, he and the Saudi Crown Prince discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis hit Lebanon. Beirut has been suffering from an economic crisis exacerbated by a diplomatic dispute between Lebanon and some Arab Persian Gulf states, especially Saudi Arabia, which had blocked imports. The rift between Riyadh and Beirut was sparked when former Lebanese information minister George Kardahi criticized the Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen. Macron landed in Jeddah after visiting the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. His visit marked the first meeting of the Western leader with Mohammed bin Salman since the assassination of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed that a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. U.S. intelligence services revealed that the gruesome killing of Khashoggi was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman. Macron's visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to rehabilitate bin Salman. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip, given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations, such as the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, threatening activists, imprisoning human rights defenders, slaughtering Yemeni civilians, and so forth. Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. However, in a stark contradiction to his assertion, the French president signed a multi-billion dollar military contract on the previous day with the UAE during his visit to the country as part of his tour.
The reality is that France will put money, will put business, will put profits before human rights, before freedom, and before democracy. And the French are very keen to expand their military relationship with Saudi Arabia, partly to increase the amount of revenue they receive from their annual weaponry sales to the kingdom, but also to compete with British military sales to the kingdom.
The UAE plays a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and millions more displaced, in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. During the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf, Macron gave a visit to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes, Rights bodies slammed the agreement, blaming the UAE for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US.
France is a leading friend and ally to the Saudis. And on top of that, Saudi Arabia is the leading exporter and financier of terrorism in the world. And so, given that France has a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia, demonstrates that not only is France complicit in terrorism, as is Britain and France, but also Paris has no regard whatsoever for human rights, democracy, or freedom.
Another country that has provided support for the Saudi regime despite its violations of human rights in Yemen is the United States. Last month, the Pentagon announced that the State's Department had approved the proposed sale of 280 advanced air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in late October. The deal is valued at up to $650 million. The missile sale followed the U.S. approval of a $500 million helicopter maintenance deal for the kingdom in September. The fact that the U.S. and France are the largest weapons exporters to Saudi Arabia brings one to the conclusion that Washington and Paris are only after selling their military hardware despite the war crimes Riyadh is committing and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives and displacement of millions more during the ongoing war on Yemen.
Simmering tensions over Ukraine threaten to pit the United States and its allies against the Russian Federation. The West has repeatedly accused Russia of preparing for an invasion as the Russian army has deployed tens of thousands of troops near the border with Ukraine. Moscow insists that it has the right to deploy forces on its own territory as it sees fit, accusing Kiev of pursuing its own buildup near the border. Russia also says it feels threatened by NATO's deepening ties with its southern neighbor, and that Ukraine is becoming increasingly involved in U.S. geopolitical games in the region. So much must be at stake in the ongoing tug of war because neither side seems willing to give an inch as tensions skyrocket between the West and Russia amid warnings that the situation could quickly spiral out of control.
Well, the U.S. has been trying to control and destabilize Eastern Europe, the Balkan region. We saw that after the fall of Yugoslavia with the U.S. and the United Nations sending troops into the region to prop up and maintain pro-capitalist, pro-American leaders.
In an attempt to defuse the standoff, American and Russian diplomats sat down for talks in Stockholm on Thursday on the sidelines of a meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The short duration of their meeting and the fact that the two opted not to appear together afterwards has given observers an impression that there is no chance of a breakthrough, at least not for now. The two top diplomats are believed to have traded threats during their brief meeting. Both remained very defiant after their talks, an indication of how deep-rooted their differences are. The United States and Russia are making no secret of their mounting tensions as top diplomats from the two sides are using bellicose language. That leaves little doubt about the gravity of the latest crisis. Blinken told his Russian counterpart that America would take unprecedented high-impact economic measures against the Russians in support of Ukraine. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, ignoring Russia's legitimate concerns, Ukraine's involvement in U.S. geopolitical games amid the deployment of NATO forces near our borders will have the most serious consequences.
In the case of Ukraine, I think the Russian government has a right to be concerned that Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, is being played as a puppet of U.S. financial interests, U.S. political interests.
Ukraine has been the main scene of geopolitical rivalry between the West and Russia for years now. The Russian Federation believes NATO wants to draw Ukraine deeper into its sphere of influence and place missile systems on Russia's borders. Moscow has demanded legally binding security guarantees that will not happen. Meanwhile, the West accuses Moscow of funding and supporting pro-Russian forces in the Donbas region, something Moscow has denied. The Ukraine equation is very complicated, and it is hard to predict how the situation will evolve. Both Russia and the United States have suggested that Presidents Biden and Putin may need to hold talks on the crisis very soon. But nothing is guaranteed on the ground, even if the two presidents discuss a standoff, because the latest escalation comes a few months after Putin and Biden sat down in Geneva for talks that mainly focused on Ukraine.
Deep-seated racism and Islamophobia once again resurfaced in the United States following threats and insults against Muslim House Representative Ilhan Omar. Lauren Boebert, a far-right Republican congresswoman, insulted Omar by suggesting that she was a terrorist to a crowd at her own state of Colorado. Boebert described encountering Omar at the U.S. Capitol and being relieved that she does not have a backpack, an apparent reference to Omar possibly carrying a bomb. Boebert further insulted Omar by describing her as a member of the Jihad Squad.
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that this isn't new in the context of racism in America, and that America has been a racist country since its founding. I think it's important to always understand or do your analysis of this issue with that being the underlying premise.
Last week, Boebert apologized to anyone in the Muslim community that she may have offended, but refused to directly refer to Omar. Following Boebert's refusal to apologize, the Muslim Democrat congresswoman received a racist, death threat-laden voicemail left for her. In a news conference on Tuesday, Omar called on Republican leadership, who have so far declined to punish Boebert over the comments, to stand up to anti-Muslim hate. Omar, who became the first Somali-American and naturalized citizen of African birth to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives when she was elected in the year 2018, said the voicemail came through shortly after Boebert posted another video on social media on Monday. "We cannot pretend this hate speech from leading politicians does not have real consequences," she said.
Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, his refusal to call out Congresswoman Lauren Boebert is an example of how morally bankrupt, how ethically vacuous individuals like this are, because they're always going to make the political calculation of how their constituents are going to respond to something like this instead of being a leader in a situation like this.
The latest insults heaped against Ilhan Omar have once again revealed the toxic environment against Muslims in the United States. Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many Muslims became the targets of anger and racism. Mosques were burned or destroyed, and death threats and harassment followed many Muslims in the weeks following the attacks. Hate crimes against Muslims rose over 1,600% from the year 2000 to 2001. But even as the country moved further from the attacks and the Muslim American population in the country grew, discrimination against this community has not waned.
And so where we are now in terms of the intra-party struggle that we're seeing, inter and intra-party struggle, where you have Congresswoman Boebert calling Congresswoman Omar a terrorist, that now is a result